With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We tell everyone, meet your 10,000 steps a day, get 150 minutes of activity every week. Some people aren't like getting half of that, so you have to set people individual targets.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, where we discuss the intersection of nutrition, lifestyle, and well-being. Today, I've got a good friend of mine, Dr. Hazel Wallace, who's founder of The Food Medic. She's a medical doctor, best-selling author, and health writer. She's also a qualified personal trainer. She's currently doing a master's in clinical nutrition and public health at UCL. She also started her own blog, The Food Medic, back in 2012. So we're talking 7 years ago now. While she was at medical school, in a bid to bridge the gap between conventional medical advice and the latest thoughts and developments in nutrition and other areas of lifestyle medicine as well. She's also host of her own podcast, The Food Medic Podcast, and a really good friend of mine, so I cannot wait to get into this discussion about how we can eat to improve public health in general. Her master's has allowed her to dive into different topics around public health in general, and so I'm fascinated into finding out a bit more about the direction that she's going in and what kind of things we can do to improve the burden currently on our healthcare systems. You can follow her at The Food Medic on all social media platforms. I will link to those in the show notes. Make sure you check out her books as well on Amazon and all good bookstores. And make sure you pre-order a copy of my book, Eat to Beat Illness, The Doctor's Kitchen. It's my new book where I discuss all elements of nutrition, lifestyle, and how that intersects with improving your brain health, skin health, immunity, supporting skin function, supporting your heart, and a whole bunch of other topics. You're going to find the recipes absolutely delicious, so make sure you click on pre-order and check it out. Now to the podcast. Hazel. Welcome to the pod. Hi. We're starting.
I know. Finally made it on the podcast.
I know. Yeah. It's good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is the first time I've seen you this year, actually. We're a couple of weeks into the new year.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't seen you in ages.
I know. It's been wild. I think the last time I saw you was at your conference.
Yes.
So tell me about you've already done a special episode on your own podcast, the Food Medic podcast, a podcast about that, which everyone should definitely listen to. Give us some feedback on what the reaction to it was. I had a great time.
So I hosted a podcast?
a podcast there as well, but yeah.
I hosted a conference titled The Future of Food. And really this came about because I wanted to... I was thinking about hosting a Food Medic branded event, but I wanted it to be hosted by scientists for the non-scientist. So I got people like yourself, experts in the field of medicine and nutrition, to basically share evidence-based advice on lifestyle measures, particularly looking towards food and sustainability. Obviously, that's a huge topic at the moment. So it was really exciting. We had 400 people come through the doors, and the tickets sold out like in 6 hours, which is ridiculous. I can't thank the speakers enough. So we had four stages running at once, which was a bit mental, but we had people like yourself. We had Dr. Sandra DeMeo, who I know that you're going to be having on the podcast.
Yeah, and he's a great connection. And thank you so much for that, because he's just, I mean, we're probably going to end up talking about some of the work that you're doing with him and some of his work with EAT. But yeah, no, he's a fantastic speaker.
He's really, really good, really engaging. Lots of our friends speaking at the event as well. And a couple of chefs also talking about how we can implement some of the advice that we are getting from kind of national guidelines and the science kind of onto our plates, like essentially how we go about it. And you guys, you and the culinary medicine team did some cookery demos there, which was great. So overall, it was such positive feedback. I definitely want to do it again. But one of the things that's happened since then is going back to uni, which you have as well. So it's just finding the time.
Yeah. Like, it's funny because the first time we met was like 3 years ago now? Probably about four years ago.
I was in my final year.
Wow. Okay. 4 years ago in Sydney whilst you were doing your elective. And we connected. And back then you had started the Food Medic, and you had a clear mission there, really, to, you know, educate the public about nutrition and improve the conversations we're having. How has the Food Medic changed over that? You've been going for like how long now?
7 years.
7 years. 7 years. The Food Medic must have changed quite a bit from when you started it and what you aspired to do when you first started to what it is now. So I'm really interested in how you, because I've watched you like along this journey, along the latter part of your journey. But how has it changed?
Yeah, so it really has changed. And if I'm completely honest, it started from quite a selfish place, not selfish in a bad way, but selfish in the fact that it came from a place where I wanted to improve my own health. And I had just finished, or is coming to the end of my first degree in medical sciences, and like, as the story goes, had put on weight and was like living a very fast food lifestyle and also not moving very much. And I thought, I was like, you know, going for my med school interviews, hoping to do postgraduate medicine, and thinking, you know, if I'm going to be a doctor, I want to be able to like live and breathe what I'm preaching to my patients. So I like joined a gym and started cooking from scratch and started an Instagram account. And this was when Instagram wasn't really a cool thing then, or it was very up and coming, and just started tracking my progress. But really, I wanted to understand from my own point of view what would be the best diet for me, and thought the best way to find that out would be in the scientific literature. And what I soon realized is there's a huge disconnect between what they were saying in papers and what I was reading in magazines and online blogs and things. And I was like, oh my God, like, because I was falling for things like Slimming World and all of these things that we should and shouldn't do that, you know, magazines that were pitched to women were telling us. So I decided to translate kind of the science and start a blog then, an extension of my Instagram. And that's when the Food Medic was born. So I started that in my very first year of med school, 2012 now. And then continued that on. So when I met you and I was in my final year, I was writing my first book, The Food Medic. And then I moved to London and started working as a doctor. I'm still doing the Food Medic today, but it's definitely not about me anymore. Yeah. And it's about we and what I can do from a public health perspective.
I love how you just brushed over the fact that whilst you were doing your junior doctoring years, which is for some people some of the hardest years that you do, certainly for me when I did my F1, F2 year, they were the hardest 2 years, you published a book. And I know what that is like, and that whole experience of having to do the promotion, having to do all the articles, having to speak to the press and all that kind of stuff whilst being a junior doctor. I mean, that's pretty impressive, Hazel.
It was... In hindsight, I'm like, how did I do that?
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, the month after publication, I got strep throat, and then I got like a gastrointestinal infection from being on antibiotics.
Yeah.
And ended up having 3 weeks completely off work and bedbound. And that was a really tough lesson to myself, that you, A, can't do everything, and also I need to also think about my own health when I'm thinking about other people's health.
Definitely.
But yeah, it like, you know, we got through it.
Yeah. And so now you've gone back to university.
Yeah.
As I have done as well. But tell us about what you're doing, where you're doing it, and what actually prompted that move.
Yeah, so I am doing a full-time master's in nutrition, clinical nutrition and public health is the full title at UCL. And UCLH is the hospital that I tend to work at, so it's all part of the one kind of family, which is quite nice, same area and things like that. But I took a year out of training after my foundation year, my first foundation year, and locumed for that year and also wrote my second book. And I was going to go back to full-time training or part-time training. And I decided that if I was going to take a career gap and study a master's, which is something that I wanted to do for a long time, now was the best time to do it when I didn't have kids. I, you know, didn't have any other commitments apart from myself or responsibilities. And I decided to just do it all in 1 year. So that's why I've gone back. I'm still locuming, also still doing the food medic and just trying to do a bit of everything. But my main focus is the master's.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about the public health side of things, because there's lots of different masters that are available there.
Yeah.
This one seems particularly unique because you're getting really a perspective on the clinical nutrition side of things, but also looking at the broader picture as well, which from the sounds of things is the way you're going with the food medic. You're really looking to answer those big questions about what challenges there are for overall health, population health, and what's burdening our healthcare systems.
Yeah, it's interesting because it is very different. It's very different looking at individual nutritional advice and then like public health messaging and also looking at evidence from that point of view. And I think, so like you said, there is lots of different masters that you can do, and getting a nutritional master's is probably the most robust after a bachelor's degree to give yourself a qualification in nutrition. So this one is focusing on public health. There's another arm to the master's where you can do eating disorders, which one of our friends, Laura Thomas, is doing. But I decided that public health was more my interest and what I basically want to get my knowledge in. And essentially, the reason that it's different is that we don't just learn the kind of nuances and physiology and you know, specific like nutrient deficiencies and things like that that you'd learn from another nutritional master's, but you also look at the other factors that come into play. So when it comes to nutrition, for example, we also need to consider other factors like socioeconomic status, we need to consider environment, we need to consider genetics, everything that would kind of, it all fits into the one puzzle when it comes to creating a nutritional guidelines, but it might not be at the forefront of everyone's mind. And it's been so insightful for me because I feel like, I almost feel like I know nothing now because I'm just like, wow, my mind is so open and I'm learning so much. But I think it will only make me a better clinician and advisor by the end of this. So that's why.
It's such a frustrating paradox there, isn't it? The more you learn, the less you feel, the less you understand, and the more you know that there is to know.
Yeah.
Like, there's just like an infinite number of papers that you need to read or conferences that you need to attend. I mean, the masters that I'm doing can be quite in depth on one particular micronutrient. So we have a Professor Margaret Raymond, she won't mind me mentioning her, who specifically goes in iodine and selenium.
Mm.
In fact, she actually lectured at the College of Medicine conference that we went to a couple of years ago, purely on iodine and why dairy was a very important source of iodine.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
I remember her.
She's a feisty Irish lady. You guys would definitely get on. I should definitely put you guys in contact. But yeah, no, like she'll just go hard on selenium and we'll just be talking about all the different sorts of sources of selenium, where you source your food sources. Selenium can vary widely. She's very anti-Brazil nuts for that reason.
Really?
Yeah, because 2 to 3 single, not even portions, 2 to 3 single Brazil nuts can give you a a toxic dose of selenium,
yeah,
depending on where you've sourced it. So if it's grown in China, for example, their soils have a higher level of selenium than average, or much higher than average. So that's concentrated in the nut itself. Mm. And that's why you've got to be careful about the number of Brazil nuts you have per day, but also per week as well.
Yeah.
So, and she's fanatical about that kind of stuff. It's kind of stuff like that that I wouldn't even have thought about,
no,
to be honest. Yeah. But yeah, I can't remember where I was going with this, but that sort of that nuance to this topic kind of gives me an understanding of why public health initiatives, why public health plates and stuff like that are so difficult to actually formulate, because there's so much evidence out there you need to consider.
Well, absolutely. And I think we as doctors and also nutritional professionals, well, less so than nutritionists, can sometimes nitpick and pick apart nutritional guidelines, particularly public health messaging, when I now really kind of look at it through a different lens and think, wow, they're actually, those guidelines are created in a way, they're probably oversimplified, but they're created so that they help the people who need them the most.
Yeah.
They may not apply to everyone, but they're trying to make them so they apply to most people. And that's why they use really basic messaging. And sometimes people don't agree with them because it may be they'll use certain rules or certain slogans so that kids and families remember them. But we have to think about who they're targeted for. And I have I had so many good discussions with Dr. Zoe Williams, a mutual friend of ours, about this. And I think understanding that is something that we all need to do.
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to criticize, actually, because unfortunately they are in a rock and a hard place. I mean, I had a patient just this week, actually, who has intractable dental pain from decayed teeth. He's actually been referred on to specialist services. He's on very high doses of opiate medications, some neuropathic medications as well. Someone has spoken to him about diet and how this has an impact on dental care and dental health. But obviously the messaging of even things like the Eat Well plate have been lost on this person, because I asked him about his diet and he's using white bread, and because he can't chew, he's literally mushing up in the front of his mouth and then eating it and then washing it down with a McDonald's milkshake. And he's been told to go on a low sugar diet, but in his mind sugar is literally the granulated stuff, and it's not in things, because you can't see the granules, therefore ergo there's no sugar in it. So it's actually that type of patient that we really need to be thinking about, because the over complicated messages of eat healthy greens, eat local, eat seasonally, or organic, these don't apply to the majority of the population.
No,
unfortunately.
No, they're not, thinking about where they're sourcing their food, or they probably don't know concepts like what legumes are. You need to break things down. And also one thing that you talk about a lot is meeting the patient where they're at. And if that patient drinks 2 liters of Coke a day and you can get them onto Diet Coke just for the meantime before getting them onto water, then that's a win.
Absolutely. You know what, that's actually something that we talk about in culinary medicine. So when we were teaching at Bristol Medical School, they had health clinics where they actually went and met patients, and they got that first-hand experience of what it's like to actually A, take a diet history, and B, make just simple suggestions as what they can do. And so even though a lot of people will be horrified to hear that we're recommending Diet Coke instead of full fat Coke, that for a lot of people is a massive step. It's a huge step in the right direction. And even though I have reservations about Diet Coke and diet beverages in general, it is a stepping stone towards a healthier lifestyle.
So you have to, you really do have to meet the patient where they're at. And if you go in with all of your ammunition and ask them to strip all the fizzy drinks from their diet and to go largely plant-based overnight and get rid of everything, are they going to stick to it?
Exactly.
Or can you meet them every week and or every couple of weeks, have a follow-up and try to meet them with different kind of targets all the time? And I do the same when it comes to physical activity. And it's like, we tell everyone, meet your 10,000 steps a day, get 150 minutes of activity every week. Some people aren't getting half of that. So you have to set people individual targets.
Yeah, definitely. And give them a little hacks. I mean, for that patient that in question, just because I know I'm going to get asked about it, what I recommended to him actually for dinner, because he can't chew, is a can of butter beans, veg stock, blend it with a stick blender and warm it up in a saucepan and make yourself a soup, essentially. Yeah. You're getting legumes in there, you're getting a good source of protein and fiber, you're getting a bit of flavor from the vegetable stock, and you add some spices to it as well. He loved that suggestion.
Really?
He was, yeah. So I'm going to see him in a couple of weeks. But like,
see how he gets on.
But it's, you know, it's just those simple little hacks that people need to be a bit more aware of.
Mm.
And this is why I think it's quite interesting when translating that into public health policy.
Yeah.
So I'd be fascinated to find out what your ideas are with regards to public health and where you think the biggest challenges are and what direction you think we should be going in.
I think we, you know, like I just said, it's
a broad question.
It's a broad question. Yeah, and when it comes to improving health from a nutritional standpoint, like I said, there's so many different moving parts that we need to be thinking of and different kind of factors that come into play. So deciding what's the best components of nutritional guidelines is one part. And the kind of Eat Well plate that we have here, I think, will change over the next couple of years, and we'll see it going towards more sustainable kind of food groups and practices and things like that. And obviously, I don't know if you've spoken about it already, but the Eat Lancet report that came out last week that was essentially giving us targets and what we need to look for from a human health perspective, but also planetary health perspective, i.e. what do we need to do to save our own health and the health of the planet?
Mm.
And that really, I mean, it's very strict. It's, you know, suggesting that we cut down our red meat consumption massively to like one portion a week, where previously we were told, oh, just do one meat-free day a week, where now it's just have one meat day a week.
Yeah.
That's very drastic for a lot of people, and particularly in the UK where we eat a lot of meat. But I think if we can take some components of that and be a bit more mindful, so shifting people towards putting as much plant-based foods on the plate, and I know you talk about this, by default shifts the amount of red meat, and dairy and processed meat that we have on our plate, but also ensures that we're getting enough fiber in there and micronutrients and things like that. So food is one part, and actually from doing this master's, I don't think it's the biggest part. It's how do we actually get that onto someone's plate? What needs to happen? So we can tell people the advice, but their environment needs to allow for that. So we both know that we don't live in an environment that promotes health. We live in an environment that promotes disease.
Yeah.
And by that I mean that we have public transport everywhere. We've got, you know, Uber's swipe of our finger. We have Deliveroo at the swipe of our finger. It's very easy to get energy dense but nutrient poor food than it is to get the opposite. So there's things that are happening within the public health sphere to help create healthier environments, and you know that was outlined largely in the obesity kind of action plan. So things like reformulation of foods, taxation of sugar sweetened beverages, also advertisement of foods to kids. We need to like start thinking about these kind of things.
This environment that they've coined an obesogenic environment is quite fascinating, actually, because if you look at the data, looking at the number of takeaways, for example, over the last 10 years, it's gone up by a third. That's okay from like a, not okay, that's not okay. It's quite shocking from a broad perspective. Actually, when you go into the details, you'll notice that in areas where there is social deprivation, there's low socioeconomic status, even though I don't like that term, that goes up even more so than in the areas of London in particular, where there is a more affluent population. So that shows that if you are in a poor environment, you are at a massive disadvantage for having a healthier lifestyle, and therefore you're going to be more of a burden. So actually, it's the fault of the environment as well as the individual, not just, you know, we can't just put all the blame on one person or one thing. But it's, I think that's absolutely fascinating that we're witnessing these inconsistencies and these differences in people's health based on their environment.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, it's not going to be one thing that will fix like the kind of double burden of malnutrition that we're experiencing, not just in the UK, but across the world. It will be all of these facets, and it's going to be a grassroots level, but also a top down approach from the government. And having like, you know, leaders in that space who are confident to speak up and actually put nutrition and things like improving the environment at the top of the agenda. So there's like interesting things that we can actually use to nudge people in the right direction. And like by nudge, I mean, so using advertisement, for example, instead of promoting at the checkout, having, you know, price promotion on foods that are high fat, high sugar and salt, having foods that are healthier on promotion and things like that. Or can we advertise healthier foods to kids in a way that's engaging for them? So now we know that, you know, chili is a good example. On their cereal boxes, they've removed all of the cartoons from the front packet. So now companies that are cereal companies can only kind of, they can use like colours and stuff like that, but they can't use cartoon characters. Yeah. But could we use those cartoon characters on foods that are nutritious and get kids engaged in that way?
Yeah.
So why don't we use the knowledge that we know that the industry's been using and improve people's health that way?
It's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what the right answer is, and that's why I think it's fascinating to have this discussion, because we're almost going in the same direction as smoking was about 30 years ago, where they were bit by bit told to reduce the sort of nudges toward their product, the sexy advertising, the aspirational Marlboro Man figures, for example, and then changing ultimately the boxes to promote actually what smoking will do to you and hiding them in totality. I mean, I don't believe we need to go down that way, that extreme at this point. But it's interesting to see the similarities between what we're seeing in public health and government top-down approaches with what's happened in the past.
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually had a discussion, or we had a tutorial yesterday in university, and they were discussing nudges. And one of the kind of experiments that they did was, when you go onto online shopping and say you type in butter, for example, and all of the searches for butter come up. But what they did is they put all of the low fat butters as kind of the top searches. And they found that there was a 66% increase in the amount of low fat butters that people bought. So then in terms of the reduction in saturated fat consumed, or that they assumed were consumed, had dropped like significantly from that one kind of project. And it's just interesting because we do that. I mean, supermarkets do that anyway. They will put whatever's on offer or whatever they want to push out at the top of your search. Yeah. So then, you know, most of us will just go to the first page and we're like, that'll do, I'll pick that one. Yeah. But if we kind of put all of the healthy stuff in people's faces, it's not forcing them to buy it.
Yeah.
We're giving people the option and letting people know that there are other options. Mm. You know, it doesn't have to be just this or just that. And I think it's putting autonomy back in people's hands, which we've really lost.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like we're entering this kind of murky field between what is the corporation's responsibility, their social responsibility to do in the actions of public health. Is it to do just that at the top of your Ocado list or whatever, promote the low fat or healthier options, or the ones that are more wholesome in terms of their ingredients, rather than the others, even if that means that they're making a loss? So it's kind of like this. And I don't know, again, I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know whose responsibility it is. Is it the governments? Is it the corporations themselves, or is it the individuals? I think it's going to be a mix and interplay of all three, to be honest.
Yeah.
If I was at this non-parliamentary think tank on Monday. Dame Sally Davies was there, who's a public health chief, and a couple other pretty influential people in the audience as well.
Yeah.
And we're all having a discussion about actually whose responsibility. And I was just looking through the brochure of the number of attendees, and they literally spanned everything from NICE to digital tech to Tesco's representatives, the media, and governmental responsibility as well. So it's interesting to see how many people, how many stakeholders there are in this discussion. Because whilst I and we like to think of the individual, the patient, as the primary focus and the overall health of the population, actually it impacts economies, it impacts our environment, it has an impact on welfare and politics as well. You know, it's very, very interesting to see, and it's a fascinating space to observe as well as be part of as well.
Yeah, I think it can also be almost overwhelming, and you can coming into this space. When I was still at medical school, I was so enthusiastic, probably when we both met in Sydney, and thought that, you know, oh my God, I've got the solution. I've got the cure for non-communicable diseases, yeah. And it's food. And it's not. It's part of it, but it's not the whole picture. I think what's really a really nice message, though, and one thing that Sandra always kind of has rephrased to me is, yeah, well, food may be part of the problem, but it's also a big part of the solution. So yeah. Like we said earlier, discussing ways that we can actually hack the system and use food to promote health.
Yeah, exactly.
Is also a nice way of looking at things.
Definitely, yeah. And just on that note, actually, the food and the quality of food and how that impacts our environment is something that has come out over the last couple of weeks with the Eat Lancet. Tell us about your involvement with that, because I'm absolutely fascinated, yeah. And I cannot wait for this podcast to come out. What's the name of the podcast?
Let's Rethink Food.
Let's Rethink Food, yeah. Okay.
So the Eat Lancet report, basically, 37 scientists have been working on this for the past 3 years. And I mean, like, scientists who are leading in their field, like, including Prof.
Prof. Will,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, go on. What were you saying? Prof.
Prof. Willett, who is, like, you know, the top epidemiologist in the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, lots of big stakeholders within the UK. And also, what I really loved is that all of the scientists on the report are from all different parts of the world. So we're not just looking at Western countries, we're looking at countries that are also low and middle income, which is really important, I think, because then we're getting inputs and experiences from every part of the world. And the reason that they wanted to do this report is because, as you know, there's this kind of double burden of malnutrition occurring across the world. And what we mean by double burden is that we're experiencing overweight and obesity happening in parallel to micronutrient deficiencies and stunting. And some of this is happening not just at like a country level or community level, but within the same household and sometimes within the same individual because of our diets, but also our environments. And this used to be a problem of the Western world, but now it's happening, you know, in developing countries. And so the report essentially set out what do we need to eat in order to improve our own health, but also ensure that we've got enough food and we kind of protect the planet by 2050. And so they set out to design this diet, but it's not just looking at diet, it's looking how we source food, it's looking at agriculture, and all of the components that come into the picture. But the planetary diet that they've essentially outlined is largely plant-based, similar to the Mediterranean diet, I guess, but it's very, very low in red meat, like we mentioned earlier, about one portion per week. Relatively low in fish, but not massively. I think it's 28 grams per day, which works out about 2 servings per week, which is what we're recommended here anyway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, small portions of poultry as well and dairy, but largely focusing on getting most of our sources from plant-based foods. And essentially, this diet came out as a blueprint. You know, it's not been implemented in any guidelines. It's a global report, but it's been received where, you know, everyone's pretty positive about it. And it's also something that I guess governments can look towards in terms of shaping guidelines and hopefully using as a bit of a target, because we're not heading in the right direction. We're not meeting the targets that we've set out to meet. You know, we're massively overfishing, we're massively like destroying the land that we've got left. So we need to figure out with the land that we do have left, how can we make more food? And so I've been working with the Eat group, who are part of the Eat Lancet Commission, for about a year now, and they asked me to come on board to help disseminate the information in a way that is understandable for everyone else, because there's no point creating a report like this and just lots of clever scientists speaking to one another about how great they are and clapping each other in the back. So I went in to ask the annoying questions.
Yeah.
What does this mean? Because a lot of it is new to me. A lot of it I didn't understand. And if I'm someone who has a background in science and reads a lot of this research anyway, then how are we going to expect people to implement it into their own diets? But it's interesting because speaking to yourself and also other professionals within the space, it's been everyone's been really positive about it. Mm. And we're probably following that diet anyway, or, you know, it would be quite easy for us. But on the day it came out, I was speaking on BBC Radio Scotland about it, and I was hosting a surgery. So I was taking questions from just the general public calling in, and one gentleman called in and he was outraged by this. Yeah, because it was so far from his diet.
Wow.
And actually, it really was an important realization for me, because I was like, it is actually all well and good us being like, eat more plants and get rid of your meat and eat 10 a day.
Yeah,
when some people are really struggling to get 3 a day, and actually having a burger on the way home from work is what they normally do, and they don't know how to cook and they don't know what a chickpea is. So it's really important that we remember that we have to treat everyone the same. And yes, the kids of Instagram know they're probably all eating that way.
Yeah, so
that is essentially what it is in a nutshell.
Yeah, that, I think that's really important to recognize, actually, the majority of people who would have read that, because it was shared thousands of times across the world. So everyone's probably heard of the planetary diet, and wicked name as well. It's such a cool name. Like, oh, how do you eat? I'm flexitarian. How do you eat? I eat for the planet, man. But no, I think for the average person in the UK who eats like a good number of portions of animal protein per week, because they've been told, you know, poultry is good for you, fish is good for you, you know, these are all messages that have come out from corporations, but also from healthcare service as well, that, you know, having good amounts of protein in your diet is meant to be a good thing. And now being told, actually, you know what, if you're going to try and protect the environment, if you're trying to protect your health, you need to ditch all animal products bar a few, and really, really changing the picture of what your plate looks like every day. And like you said, a lot of people don't know what to do with chickpeas. I'm probably guilty of saying the word legumes far too many times as well on like social media and stuff.
But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And a lot of people go back to, well, historically we, you know, we were hunter gatherers and we ate a lot of meat. Actually, we didn't. We probably, you know, killed a goat or a sheep and had that for a couple of weeks and ate from that. We didn't eat, you know, a big steak every night.
Yeah.
And it's about rethinking how we look at food. And we live in an environment where, you know, it's very, especially here, that, you know, it's very affluent from a food perspective, that you can have a big steak or a big burger whenever you want. But we need to think about our health, and particularly, and I don't want to demonize any foods, and I definitely try not to do that within my own diet. But when it comes to our health as well, processed meats and red meats, there is a strong correlation there when it comes to specific diseases, especially colorectal cancer. And that evidence is relatively robust, so we have to respect that. And if people are interested in protecting their health, it's in their interest to reduce it. But that's not saying that you can't have a burger every once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I find the whole experiment that we're sort of undertaking over the next couple of years, where we try and change behaviours, really one as much of physical health, but one of psychological health as well.
Yeah.
Because once you've given something or given someone the availability of having salmon, steak or anything at the click of your fingers at a very good price point, like you'll find in supermarkets up and down the country, and then turn around and say, but you can't have that and you shouldn't have that, and, you know, the psychological impact of that, I think, is massive for a lot of people just not interested in this in whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, so it's January and I'm currently doing Veganuary.
Yeah, how's that going?
So yeah, that's what I just was going to bring up, because I thought last year I wasn't in the position to do it. I didn't feel like you said, that I was ready to do it, and it is a big undertaking. But I eat a largely plant-based diet anyway. My biggest kind of non-plant-based foods would be cheese and eggs.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's a month, I can do it. And also, when I'm advising people who are vegan, it's really important for me to understand the limitations and obstacles that they come up against.
Definitely.
So I wanted to do it as a challenge, and I'm still doing it. But I've definitely run into problems. So, not problems, but difficulties. And One, I'm definitely missing my cheese. I'm also doing dry January, so it's a very, very sobering month for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But last week I travelled to Ireland, where I'm from, but I travelled to a part
of... Oh, really?
Of-
I didn't. I couldn't tell.
but I travelled to a part of Ireland that's quite rural for an event. And trying to get even a vegetarian meal was so hard.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really struggled. And I just thought, we have it so lucky here in London. Mm. You know, like, we are so privileged.
Yeah.
But expecting people to go plant-based for it to be tasty and accessible across the world is a big ask.
Yeah, totally.
So we need to be able to implement, like, give people actual tools. And I think, like you just said, the advice that you gave to your patient, that's one example of how we can translate what it says in that guideline into real life practice.
Absolutely, yeah. I went, I completely resonate with the whole vegan thing, because I was doing a talk back in 2016 at Vivolution. I'm not sure if it's still good. I think it must be still going.
I think it still is.
It's probably like thriving massively.
So
I was giving a talk there, and I thought, in preparation for the talk, I'm going to go vegan for a month and just see, as a social experiment, just how hard it is. And obviously, living in London, we're a massive privilege, but I found that fairly... It was definitely an eye-opening experience for me, just to know how many things have cheese on. Like, every salad you get has got feta or parmesan on it or something, or somewhere someone slipped in milk into the ingredients list and everything. So it can be really tough.
Even in like curry paste, they put like shrimp in it.
Yes, they do.
And I didn't realise this.
Yeah.
I didn't use it, but someone flagged it to me, and I was like, oh, I know that you probably make your own curry paste. You're like, oh,
say
well, that's
that,
not a problem with
last
me.
Last night, I used a yellow curry paste on purpose. I faked it, and I was very honest about it, because sometimes, you know, you don't have the mental energy, or like, you know, the whole, you've got to get lemongrass and galangal and shallots and stuff. You know, just get a paste, and sometimes, you know, every now and then that's fine. But if you are doing veganuary, then you've got to make sure.
Yeah, so it's little things like that I've like, or, you know, I visited, you know, a family friend and was given a cup of tea, and they just instantly put cow's milk in
it.
I'm not going to be like, take that back, Bridget. I'm not drinking it. So you just, I think we all, I mean, I know that I'm not going to go completely vegan just yet. I'm not, never say never.
Mm.
But it's been really good as well, because I've learned to be more experimental with my plant-based eating. And I definitely think moving forward, I probably will be largely plant-based and veggie. I mean, I don't really miss red meat anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, 3 years ago, I would have probably had red meat twice a week or three times a week.
Yeah.
Some people have it every night. So I think we need to be very measured when we're giving this advice and tell people, you know, you don't have to do this overnight, and please don't, because
you'll
probably run yourself into problems.
Absolutely. Actually, you know what, that was some of the feedback I got off my first book. People would literally like bought the book and would want to do every single recipe every single night, and obviously my recipes have like loads of legumes, chickpeas, beans, that kind of stuff in. So I had all these messages like, am I meant to be a little bit more bloated, a bit more farty with these recipes? I'm like, you probably, if you just go hard at it like completely from day one,
oh,
but you've got to ease your way into introducing more vibrant, otherwise you're going to know about it and everyone else is going to know about it.
So. It's so true. I'm getting so many of those messages because it is Veganuary. Everyone's like, oh my god, I can't stop farting. And I'm like, it's quite normal, but probably try to tone down the fiber and drink a lot of water. And
you've got to think about it from the perspective of your microbes. They're probably like having a massive party, like, wow, we've got all this fiber, this variety, it's amazing, it's colourful and up in here, and they're having a party. So yeah, you just got to like ease your way into it.
100%.
Yeah. So with regards to the rest of your public health masters and stuff, you've got like another like 6 months or so, 7 months?
Yeah, I've handed my thesis in August.
Okay, and have you got any idea of what you want to do with that knowledge? Because like, it's a huge undertaking that you're doing, like essays and you've got exams coming up, right? Yeah. What kind of direction do you want to go in with public health now?
It's crazy because 6 months ago, I don't think I would have said this, but I definitely want to go into public health policy. I think...
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. We need more medics who have got the experience of going to public health. That's great.
Yeah. I'm really passionate about public health, and particularly when it comes to helping to kind of reduce the amount of non-communicable diseases and in any way have an impact, in any way try to shape policy to improve that. And that I really see that this is my vocation now. I definitely mourn the fact that I'm not in clinical practice full time, because I worked, not only did I work my ass off to get into medicine in the first place, but I really enjoy it. Like, I love seeing patients all the time. But I've come to the understanding that I can do more from this level. So if I can get into policy, I never thought I'd ever get into politics, but I've somehow found my way in there.
Yeah.
And I seem to have, when I talk to people, that's when I get my most, I get really passionate. So I think I just have to go with it.
Yeah.
And that's where I see it heading. I definitely want to work more within the media in disseminating information, and I'll continue doing the food medic as an extension of my, like, my own work. But yeah, it's definitely super interesting how it's come around this weird journey that I've been on.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I echo that. I never thought I'd be teaching medical students like knife skills and how to chop an onion and stuff like that, and facilitating their conversations in clinic and trying to like elevate the conversation around food and lifestyle in general, and how that segues into conversations around, you know, stress at home and family life and food security and things like that. But yeah, no, it's just quite interesting to see our journeys individually and how they've meandered along the way.
Yeah.
I kind of loathe the fact, I mean, I still do clinical medicine, but I like you, have taken a massive chunk out of my clinical work to focus on the Doctor's Kitchen, the non-profit stuff with culinary medicine. And yeah, it is a bit weird at the start, but then you kind of realize you can actually have a massive impact on public health by using your platform, by using your resources and learning about this subject. And that's what I was going to ask you actually about. If you had an area to focus on, probably not just to focus on, but with public health, if you had a magic wand, what kind of areas would you focus our attention on? If you could actually, you know, improve aspects of public health, which ones would you focus on?
I think public health messaging and communication. I've been lucky enough to sit on a couple of kind of roundtables with Public Health England recently, and where I feel like I offer the most benefit is how can we engage like millennials and young people, because social media obviously plays a huge part, and it's really important in how we, the words that we use, how we communicate things. And it's that those kind of campaigns are not just healthy eating advice, but also things like cervical screening, stopping smoking, keeping antibiotics working, things like that. But they're all so important, except they're not important if they fall on deaf ears. And if we can't engage people, then I don't think we're going to benefit anyone. So I guess my work from just looking at food has really expanded into all areas of public health, which, again, I didn't expect and I didn't really think I had a passion for. But it all fits in into the one, like, the one pot. So I think I would definitely have a couple of suggestions when it comes to the advice that we give out from a healthy eating point of view. I love to work on that and shape that. So I think food will always be my main passion, like public health nutrition, but also the other areas of nutrition. I think being a medic allows me to kind of fully understand those issues there. And I mean, we've had really, really successful campaigns when it's come to smoking. So like you said, why can't we use that and take that forward with other things?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like the Action for Obesity stuff. You've done like a lot of reading around that and stuff.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that actually going forward? Do you think that's one of the solutions to the issues that we see burdening our healthcare service? Or do you think it's actually, there's nuance to it and there's actually wider things, or things that we're missing in terms of our messaging?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things that we're missing in terms of our messaging. And, you know, there's a couple of people who are within the same field as us that are probably better at kind of articulating this, like the Girls of the Rooted Project. But when it comes to the obesity action plan that was released last year, that is essentially focusing on childhood obesity. And what we're seeing in terms of obesity rates, definitely there has been an increase from the 1990s, but that has slowed down in the past 2 years. And actually, we're not seeing massive increases, but we are seeing increases in certain kind of childhood age groups.
Yeah.
And what we need to do, I think, in order to give our children, and I'm not a mother, just for full disclosure there, because I know that some people bring that up, but what we need to do is give them the best opportunity for a healthy life. Mm. And in order to do that, you know, they don't have full control over what they have for their dinner or what's in their lunchbox, but we can help create an environment so that they do have the options and that they do have a long, healthy life. So I think these strategies... And when I say these strategies, I mean the public health strategies, and that's reformulation, so creating lower calorie foods and lower sugar foods, taxation of sugar sweetened beverages, censoring of TV advertisements, but also kind of removing price promotions from checkouts, and also engaging communities and schools so that they can create environments for kids, because it's all well and good telling them to move more, but if they don't have a cycle path or they don't have a green area to play in, then they can't. And we know that the kids that are most affected are those from the kind of lower income families, because those areas are more deprived from this kind of these kind of activities and things like that. So it really does require a huge amount of movement from government level. But also it requires people like you and I to speak up from a public health point of view and say, this is actually really important and this is why. And there's lots of things that people can do on an individual level, but I don't agree with putting all of this whole person approach, kind of individual responsibility. It is your fault that you're in this position, that you have poor health, that you're obese. When we know that obesity is a huge... It's a multifactorial, it's not just caused by eating too much and moving too little, although excess energy tends to lead to excess fat deposition, which is obesity, defined by BMI. We know that it's not just food and exercise, it's also genetics. You know, it's like 70% heritable. It's also your environment. It's also your psychosocial status. You know, we don't just eat because we're hungry anymore. Yeah, you know, we eat because it's pushed in front of us. We eat because it's advertised to us. We eat because it's a social thing.
Yeah.
We've got this really complex relationship with food. And I think we need to start understanding how we shape obesity, because there is no denial saying that someone who is obese has a higher risk of all of those comorbidities that we discussed, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, you know, insulin resistance, high cholesterol. And so in order to protect people's health, we do need to help prevent them from becoming obese in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's those who are morbidly obese and having a BMI, which is, you know, we've got levels of obesity and, you know, there's severe obesity. And we know that that, you know, gives us the greatest risk of these diseases.
Definitely, yeah.
And that is what not only has a burden on human health, but it has a burden on our economy, strains on the NHS, which we come back to time and time again. So it's looking for solutions, but also not looking at people as just a burden and not using those words and not using words like tackling and, you know, all of these things that you hear in the news.
Definitely. It's definitely a multifactorial condition, I think, that has so many different roots as well. It's kind of like when you examine the obesogenic environment, you're also looking at the psychogenic environment, and there's so many different similarities. You are really a product of, yes, your family history, yes, your genomics, yes, what you eat, but also your environmental surroundings, your level of education, where you were privileged or unprivileged to grow up as well. There was a paper actually that came out of King's College just 2 weeks ago, looking at the associations, just an association, the association between low socioeconomic status and the diversity of your microbiota as well.
Yeah.
So there are so many different factors. I mean, this is before we go into
the microbiome's another.
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge. And then obviously that comes down to food systems as well, and the use of antibiotics, not only on personal health, but also from an animal livestock point of view as well. It's very, it, you know, it, it's a hugely, hugely difficult subject. It's kind of like the topic of stress. You know, yeah. You can never really be thought of as anyone's fault for being stressed or having social isolation, but yet it still happens, and it's something that we need to address.
Mm.
The way we go about it shouldn't isolate, it shouldn't blame, it shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be using those sorts of negative connotations. And the same thing with obesity. You can actually be a product of something that's completely out of your control.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important to actually incorporate that into public health strategy, because that would actually lead to a lot more engagement, I feel, as well.
Yeah, and I think if we focus on the healthy behaviours and creating a healthier environment, that's probably a more positive message, because we know that people are more likely to actually engage in those behaviours if they're not stigmatised. Mm. And, you know, like, I think there was a huge debate about that campaign that came out last year from Cancer Research, which said, you know, the leading cause of cancer is obesity, and you had to fill in the letters. And I had feedback from even family members of patients who said, like, leaving the hospital and seeing that really wasn't helpful.
Yeah, I really didn't like that. I've had a few friends, discussions with friends, actually, from oncology, from public health and stuff, and there's really mixed feelings about that. Some people are, like, very pro that, like, everyone needs to know. But at the same time, I'm kind of at the camp, like, okay, I understand what the thinking was behind it, because A, we're talking about it, and now it's known that there is a link, fair enough. But actually, from the perspective of a patient with cancer, or someone who feels that they are at risk of cancer as a result of their own actions because of blame for being overweight, it's just not helpful. And it just adds to the isolation, the feelings of being reprimanded by your own actions.
Mm.
And it doesn't really give people a path to follow, or like direction to actually help themselves.
Yeah.
So, it's a tough one, that. But it's interesting to see how mixed people's responses were to it.
Yeah, no, it really is. And, you know, like I always say, I am not, denying that if you are obese, that you do not have an increased risk of these certain conditions. Particularly, there's like a collection of diseases, breast cancer and things like that, that you can increase your risk of. But having, it's also important to understand that BMI is a useful measure from a population level, but it's not always always useful on an individual level in isolation. Mm. And what I mean by that is just taking BMI and not understanding the whole picture is not useful, because we know that you could be 6 foot and you could be full of muscle and you could be considered obese because you have a high BMI.
Yeah, yeah.
So in those instances, we should be taking, you know, waist-hip ratios. We need to also understand where the fat deposition is. And that's why people always say, you know, apple kind of shapes tend to be higher risk.
Mm.
And that's because they have visceral fat deposition. And that is the fat that is around our organs.
Mm.
And we know that that's not inert, in that it doesn't just sit there. It's metabolically active. It's producing hormones all the time. It affects how hungry we are. It affects how full we feel. So having extra fat also is affecting your health, because it's doing all these things on the inside that we're not really aware of. It's not just about being heavier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, like, even when I see people in clinic, you know, it's at the extremes of that U-shaped curve with BMI that we need to be flagging up, but also combining that information about BMI with things like waist-to-hip ratio, with things like their biometrics and their lab studies, their family history, their current comorbidities. You know, there's so many different nuances to the subject. It's never just going to be defined by one thing. But certainly at a population level, we kind of go to the lowest common denominator. And that's why I think it's good to have someone like yourself in public health policy, which we hope to do in the future.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Absolutely. And I do get, you know, like, BMI is such an easy measure. Mm. It's like, it's universal. We use it across the world, but it does have its downfalls. And the thing is, we need to have these discussions, and I think all of this research is helpful, but it's just, we need to discuss it amongst one another, different health professionals. What does this mean for the individual? And I think that's what it comes back to. You know, the World Cancer Research Fund brought out their latest statement recently, and they kind of like outline all of the risk factors from a lifestyle point of view, and they kind of have that compared to all the different cancers. And body fatness, i.e. obesity, you know, comes up against a lot of the cancers, but also so does smoking and physical inactivity and things like height, so adult height, which I was really confused by. So there's lots of different things that we need to take into consideration, but we need to be a lot more careful with and just a bit more sensitive with how we phrase things.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a great overview of public health in general. I think we did it. Are there any particular resources you think the listeners should go check out? Certainly, I'd link to the Eat Lancet report for sure. I think that'd be great, interesting read for most people.
Yeah.
And I think there's a website that breaks it down for the average
reader. If you go onto the EAT website, EAT, they have a summary report up there, which is kind of just outlines exactly what that is. And then the podcast will be coming out sometime in the next couple of weeks. But check out myself and Sandra's channels for that. And that will just be like a 7 to 8 episode podcast going through all the different core elements of the report, which all, with all of the scientists who are on the report. So that'll be interesting. And other than that, I would just say, you know, like, I definitely try to put as much up on my website, which is thefoodmedic.co.uk, and interview people on my podcast as well. One of the episodes I would flag would be Dr. Giles Yeo, who is a geneticist, particularly focusing on obesity. And he really talks about the kind of genetic basis of obesity, and also the podcast episode with Dr. Zoe Williams and Dr. John Sykes talking about, for GPs, kind of how do we actually implement all of these campaigns with our patients. And I think that will be it. Other than that, I would just say to everyone who does see public health campaigns who come out, or they see reports like the Eat Lancet report, take it with a pinch of salt. These are just guidelines. You know, no one is forcing you to do any of this. And also remember who this report is. It's to help, or these kind of reports are to help the majority of people. So it's not to take away from anyone's life, it's to add to it.
Always an absolute pleasure chatting to Hazel. I'm so glad she finally made it onto the podcast, and you can catch her on socials at The Food Medic. Check out the website, thefoodmedic.co.uk. All the links to her socials will also be on my website, thedoctorskitchen.com. To summarise our conversation, we talked about a whole bunch of different topics: state and corporate responsibility for ensuring that people are actually offered the healthier choices. Things like Ocado putting top results actually being healthier choices for them, like the low sugar items or more whole foods, rather than the nutrient poor, calorie dense options that are usually promoted to us. Giving the general public reasonable targets when it comes to food and what we should be aiming for. Expectation management is something that's very, very interesting. You know, there is a stark difference between what we see on Instagram and what I see in clinic when I'm talking to patients and what their plates actually look like. Fiber, fiber, fiber. We always talk about fiber in the show. Fiber is so important. We are not hitting our guidelines of over 30 grams a day, which is a crushingly low amount in my opinion, but we should be at least achieving 30 grams per day. You can get this from beans, nuts, legumes, chickpeas, one of my favorites. One of the recipes that I find helps people hit that fiber content are my spicy chickpeas, which you can have for brunch, and it's very popular amongst the nursing staff in my hospital, who often have it for brunch on Saturdays. Also, don't forget my new book, Eat to Beat Illness, is going to be out on the 21st of March. You can pre-order on Amazon and all good bookstores as well. Check out my website, where I'm going to have lots of interesting information. Subscribe to the newsletter and give this podcast a 5-star review. It really does help people get that information, and it's going to be useful for so many people out there. Thanks so much, and I will see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.